Dr. Teal?
Yes.
Good evening or afternoon, I guess, in California. This is Bob Ward again.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Well, good. I hope your dental work went well.
Yes.
Good. Have you had a chance to give some thought?
I don't know if I have anything to say anymore. I saw Werner von Braun the last time before he died during the Pioneer 10 or 11 celebration.
At which celebration?
Pioneer 10 or 11. I don't know what.
Oh, I see.
And he was at Ames, and there was a delay, and he and I went on to the supper together. It was after he left NASA.
I see. I see.
And I thought he would respond, but just the opposite happened. He said, I don't know exactly what he was, but he expressed his confidence in the American news.
I see. I see.
But that was the last time I spoke to him.
Right, and he was with Fairchild then?
Yes.
And about what year was that? Obviously between 72 and 77, but...
I don't know. It was either the Pioneer 10 or 11. Jupiter Encounter.
I beg your pardon? Oh, I see.
When near 10 or 11.
Ah, okay.
Reached Jupiter. And he was at Ames, suicide. And there was a show about 2 hours or 3 hours waiting period.
I see.
And I went out to lunch.
Ah, and it was lunch that you...
No,
that you
dinner.
Oh, dinner, right.
And I forgot the... As I said, he was... apparently, he had every right to be disappointed.
I see. He was very frustrated, wasn't he, in his 2 years at NASA headquarters?
Oh, yes.
Right.
He was brought in by Penn.
Yes.
And Penn had left, and
I guess Fletcher came in.
Fletcher and Tom Hunt and Lowe.
Lowe, right.
Yes, it made it impossible for Werner to see.
I see. You know, before you left Huntsville, which I think you said was about 1954 or something?
55,
okay.
Spring 55.
I beg your pardon?
Spring 55.
Spring of 55. Let me make a note of that. And you were the highest ranking member of the team next to von Braun, weren't you? Weren't you considered his highest colleague?
Well, I don't know. No, I really don't think.
Okay. What was your technical specialty? I know you have a PhD in...
Yes, and I started out with control...
Control, right.
And guidance theory, and later on become system engineering.
In engineering, systems engineering, I see. Right. Do you... You know, the Pina Munda, you were at Pina Munda, correct?
No.
Oh.
I was in Darmstadt.
In Darmstadt, okay. Was that an Air Force facility or?
The Darmstadt?
Yes.
Or
university.
Under contract to Pina Munda.
Ah, okay. And there were a number of such arrangements, weren't there?
Yes.
At various universities.
Amsterdam
has
most of it.
Ah, I see. And did you go and visit Pina Munda from time to time?
Yes.
I see. Do you recall any specific incidents that might be interesting? Little short stories, not necessarily humorous. I guess certainly in those war years, humor may have been in short supply, but...
Yeah.
Do you recall any particular little stories or vignettes or incidents at Pina Munda?
Not really.
I see. And I guess Dr. von Braun came to Darmstadt from time to time, did he, to see you?
Yes.
I see.
I went to Pina Munda quite often.
I see. What would you say is what was the most prominent or outstanding character trait or personality quality of Dr. von Braun?
Charming.
Charming, huh? He had lots of charm, huh?
Oh, God. He charmed you. Depends on you.
Is that right? You know what?
Was a great charmer. And at the same time, he was absolutely convinced what he was doing was right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I see.
And as I said, last meeting we had with him during lunch, I gave him an opportunity. I'm short against Fletcher and Tom Lowe.
Mm-hmm.
He refused. And he said, said before, he expressed a fantastic confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Of this situation.
I see. That eventually the program would go forward again.
Yeah, yeah.
I see. Right. Did you get the feeling that Dr. von Braun went to NASA headquarters reluctantly from what he may have said in the beginning?
No, because he was invited by Payne.
I see. Ah, that made a difference.
Oh, yes. And Payne was a strong supporter of Werner. And he wanted to have Werner in the headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it didn't turn out.
Right. It didn't stay. And I guess perhaps politically it was sensed that the... American taxpayer wasn't willing to continue footing the bill or something.
Well, not. Not really.
I see.
I think Fletcher and Lowe had a personal vendetta against Wilco.
Ah, I see. Yeah. Right. Yes. Do you think any of Lowe's feelings were perhaps related to wartime and?
I often thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Lowe was born in Vienna.
I beg your pardon?
Do you know that Lowe was born in Vienna?
In where in?
Austria.
Oh, in Austria.
Yes.
No, I've been told that he was Jewish.
Yes, sir.
And he was born in Austria. Ah.
In Vienna.
In Vienna, I see.
And he
of course, Germany took over.
Yes.
Austria and Vienna.
And I think he couldn't tolerate von Braun.
I see.
Honestly.
Uh-huh. And then it was not much better with Fletcher, was it?
No.
Hmm.
But Lowe was the main reason.
I see.
Hello.
Yes, I'm sorry, I was writing a note here. Is there any little, I could say anecdote in your years of involvement with von Braun, you know, either any funny little story or any pointed story that might be poignant or some vignette where you observed, you know, something occur that might reflect on Dr. von Braun's personality or genius or whatever.
Whatever was written about me, my position.
Yes.
I cannot add to that.
Oh, okay. All right. That was a good little story.
Yeah.
I'll probably quote you on that then. All right. Well, thank you, sir. I hope things go well with you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. Nice to talk with you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Hello.
Dr. Teal, forgive me, Bob Ward. One quick question, if I may. You spent your career after 55 working with whom? You went with a company, did you?
Yes.
Yes, and was that, who was that? General Dynamics?
No, TRW.
Oh, TRW.
TRW.
Ah.
It started out with Space Technology Laboratory.
I see.
Yeah.
Ah, I see. Well, now, it originally was Space Technology
Laboratory.
And that was a separate company?
No, it was a
subsidiary. Oh, I see. Space Technology Lab, a subsidiary. Okay. And that's, of course, where Dan Golden came from.
Yes, sir.
Did you know him?
Oh, yes, sir.
I see.
Very, very much.
I see, okay. You probably helped raise him. All right. Again, forgive me for the call back, but that was a little gap in my information. All right, thanks again. Bye.
I seem to relate to what you were looking for in terms of not technical and the programmatic decisions and those kinds of things.
That is correct.
You covered those yourself. And these are things which, when I thought about them, struck me in my mind of things which humanize him a little bit.
Great,
in
exactly.
Some way, the kind of conditions he lived under. And you recall 201 fire.
Yeah.
And,
right.
It was all... That triggered so many things internally to NASA that, and Marshall that put a lot of plans on the back burner, including Webb's plan to use Marshall in the Marshall Management System to introduce it into universities.
Right.
This is going to be a big deal. He'd land up Syracuse came down to the real in-depth study of Marshall on how they manage things.
Mm-hmm.
We thought it was as humans at the time that
right.
we did that, but we have wanted something. That's what he, but the fire.
Right. And I do want you to tell me again that story about Webb and Von Braun meeting and where Everhard Reed
yeah, that's
was
about.
First
thing yeah, yeah. But that kind of get followed on the 205 and that the fire where Webb came down, and I don't really recall the exact purpose of coming down, but it was a big meeting as usual on the 10th floor conference room, and we were presenting the programs and those kind of things, and then during some point in time, Webb asked Von Braun to have a private conversation. We stepped down to his office, and you can imagine the MSC and North America were in quite a state of turmoil.
Right.
It was a pretty sloppy job, and tying into that, and I don't, you might not want to, I don't think maybe you should use this, but I recall an instance before this where Von Braun, we were out at Downey, and with Lee Atwood, walking down between the buildings out there for some reason, just kind of not out of the blue, but it was, he doesn't do these things out of the blue, he thought through this thing Von Braun did. He said, Lee, he said, Stormy has got to go. And Lee said back, said, we can't replace him. Well, it ended there. But that was a good comment on Von Braun and a lousy comment on Lee Atwood. If Lee Atwood couldn't replace somebody, does that lead to, I don't know what it led to, but
sure.
He should have been replaced. He was doing a miserable job. And but anyway, Webb came down to the office, and Von Braun and Webb and they were discussing what could be done, and I think this, sometimes people make trips to for certain purposes, and I think this was Webb's purpose. He wanted Everhard Reeves to go out to Downey.
Webb did,
To spend time out there and take a team and pull this thing together,
mm-hmm.
Get quality and so forth. He was very impressed with Everhard and had a good reputation. And so he talked back and forth to Von Braun. He told Von Braun, says, if he does that, and we get out, come on, I will get him in to see President Johnson. I think it was President Johnson, but Von Braun wasn't opposed. He wasn't opposed. He thought Everhard could do those kind of jobs, so he called Everhard down. Everhard came in, and right between the eyes, they kind of set him up, you know, with a good cup talk.
Right.
And they wanted him to go out there and straighten this mess out.
Right.
And Everhard didn't object at that point in time, and he wasn't stunned or anything like that, but he just, you could tell he was kind of taken back by it. And then Webb went back to the meeting, left Von Braun and Reese and myself in the office there, and Everhard just kind of downcast, and as I recall him now, and his hands, he just kind of walked around the room, you know, he was so stunned that Von Braun would do something like that without him, at first, he could give him a clue.
Sure,
on there.
Sure.
Well, all right, but anyways, then the end of that short conversation with Everhard, he acquiesced. He said he'd go, you know. And in his typical fashion, he pulled together some of the best guys we had.
Mm-hmm.
They went and spent months and months and went through that thing like it was their own baby, you know. I mean, this was their charge. And it's one thing about them, I think, in most instances, Bob, you sure have noted this, that maybe people who succeed do the same thing. But these, the Everhard and a lot of his compatriots, they were, they're given a task, they did it. We had a colonel,
sure.
You know, Bob.
Good soldiers.
Good soldiers, just do it.
Yeah.
And some of our guys just wouldn't do that. I mean, in fact, we had Director Lewis, and he toured Mississippi Test Facility. I took him down and showed him what we were doing, and told him how we did it, and put a team down there from here on TDY, like the team going out to Dr. Downey, and he said, how do you do that? Well, the answer was, you just say, Bob, why do you do that?
Right.
You know, don't give him too many options, and it sounds brutal, but that's the way you get the thing done. He apparently ran it on a volunteer basis, and he said he couldn't stand remote sites. Well, that said, told me something about that operation.
Mm-hmm.
But this worked out well. We had a lot of people that went out, and they made a lot of corrections, and
What did Everhard say
when after Webb left, it was something to the effect, Werner, you didn't tell me.
Werner, you didn't tell me anything. Why didn't you tell me? You didn't tell me. And what, that's when he's pacing around the room, head down, and he thought he would had been done in. And, you know, in a sense, that's not the good explanation of it, but almost, if you look at Ron Brown's stature and Reese's stature and their maturity and their technical competence and all those things, he was kind of like, a father and a child, or a teacher and a pupil, and young, just like he's got a child at, you know. Sure, what child's about it, but that reaction, it stuck with me.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it
and it was a mean, tough, dirty job. But vital.
Yeah, they went into a mean, tough environment now too. Of course, North American. I'm pretty confident we're happy to have somebody come in, whether it was good or bad, to share the blame if something else had come out.
Is sure.
They could say, well, they couldn't straighten out either, you know. And
right.
I don't think it would at the a lot of levels at Houston. There wasn't two of them accepted either.
Sure. Yeah. What was Stormy's full name? Now it was last name Storms.
Storms, yeah. And I can't recall his first name. Yet.
But his title was.
He was. I assume I have to make up a title. He was the director of the spacecraft contract with Houston.
Right.
And. And I think all of us, and maybe in life too, and that we have something that we're committed to, like a contract. And if we're doing it with somebody we know pretty well, we don't check enough.
Mm-hmm.
I know when the ATM, the solar panels collapsed on the Skylab. That we had another thing, ATM went up. It had solar panels on it. We were over that contractor, TRW did. We rode them like a fleas on a dog. And nothing they could do. We weren't in there proving it. And then what McDonnell Douglas did, and that was a contract to McDonnell Douglas for the solar panels for that. But what McDonnell Douglas did, they designed the solar panels in the house.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have that penetration because you work. Like a newspaper, I guess. You shouldn't have one guy in a printing room come in and tell them the circulation department how to do the business. They
sure.
Listen to you.
Right.
You have peers. And so it hurt us in Skylab and helped us in ATM. But that's, I think, the same kind of thing at MSC and the investigation out there, not the investigation so much as a team to go out to get put corrective actions in.
Right. And I think you were telling me earlier, weren't you, about that meeting where Ron Brown with Stormy sitting there, were you telling me, announced that he was going to have to go? Did you tell me that or somebody else?
I don't know. It might be somebody else now.
I've talked to Jim Daniels recently and some others anyway.
It could well have been, and that's escaped my memory right now, but we said a lot of tough meetings and not too small a meeting. Too, where these kind of statements come out, and like one meeting, Herman Weiner says, you people in North America like to lean out the windows. You lean out too far on the design of the S1 on the S2, in the fabrication and production of that thing. And he used a term I hadn't heard that term before, but lean out the window, you're going to lean too far, you're going to fall right out.
Mm-hmm.
And he got rather outright. So
that means taking too great risks?
Too great risks, and maybe not pursuing. You could say not pursuing the right course in certain instances on those kind of things. And these were tough meetings. They should have been tough. Too often in the programs and the defense and NASA too and anything else, you get too cozy with the contract. In a sense, you're not being illegal, but you give them more tolerance and more leeway, like your children,
Sure.
And
I'd forgotten that North American was the contractor for the S2 stage.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And Von Braun chided them.
He's chatted him quite a bit. Yeah, we go out there. He's just pulling a punch for them either now. And one satellite, we had, they blew up a test stand out at San Susano testing the S2 and components of it. And it was in, like the middle of the night. I'm not sure which one calling now. The president of one of the out there calling at home around midnight, something like that. And of course, it worked up on the ground and woke up Maria.
Mm-hmm.
Maria, she never could understand why they called him.
Right.
You know, you think about it, you think, well, that's a dumb question for her to ask. On the other hand, what can you do at midnight? But I thought her reaction was not improper, but it surprised me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd have taken a phone call at 2 or 4 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
Sure.
And that was interesting then.
Did she refuse to take the call?
No, they took the call.
Oh, okay.
What are you calling you? In the morning like that, you know? And because he was the program.
Sure.
You better report it to him, really.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than somebody call him in the morning and say, hey, about 11 o'clock, say, we're not listening, you blow up a test. Well, you don't want him to be in the dark like that.
Sure. I should have looked up to see if the Times had your bio sketch in there.
Mm-hmm.
You were at Marshall from when to when?
Well, see, I came to Huntsville in 50.
Right.
Working with the Army and in instrumentation. John McDaniel.
That was pre-ABMA, obviously.
Way
pre-ABMA.
John McDaniel and myself were both GS-7s and learned a lot from John and worked pretty close together for a while.
And you were working in what field, what area did you say?
Instrumentation.
Yeah, okay.
Flight instrumentation, right. Static test stands. And we had one great thing that happened that we were going to expand the area and redesign the test areas. And so there was nobody around but John McDaniel, myself, and I hadn't been out of tech long. He hadn't seen much either. We designed these things with AE and set certain criteria down and wound up with a building that one of the guys that ran the test and evaluation part at that time, he didn't think that room buildings with computers in should have windows. So we wound up saying there was no windows in this building, which is another story. But we're also located too close to the test area, the old static test area down there. But the static test area, we learned a great lesson this thing, that how to design static test stands. What we did, we put massive concrete block in that stand, a certain amount of thrust and so forth, big block behind it, and down all reinforced bars, rebar on the bottom and on the walls, and we put a roof on it. Same thing, a rebar's up there, put concrete, dirt on top of there, and nothing can happen here. So everything's going well, and we tested some rocket that leaves us a thiocol that put together the Pecker and Accolade propellant. And we had tested several of them and had been evacuating our buildings because it was so close to a test stand.
Mm-hmm.
And this time the question came up between myself and Red Berry, who was chief of the range there, and should we evacuate? And I said, well, let's do it this time. Let's do it this time. And if it goes right, we won't do it next time. And when they threw that switch, and we got all the guys out of the building, had a bunch of cars around the parking lot there. As soon as we hit that button, that thing went first high order. It was equivalent to 700 pounds of TNT going like that. It took that roof off that thing, and it threw blunts of concrete that weighed a ton. I mean, it threw them way down to another range down there, which is half a mile or a mile away. And then all this stuff started raining down. We had about 40 cars, private cars, damaged. Money I'm ruined. The motors were sitting on the ground. Had a 2.5-ton truck back here, and one of the big pieces hit that bed of that thing and drove the rear axle wheels, rear wheels, into the blacktop down to the axle where it got more bearing service. Almost totally destroyed our building. And some of the guys, one of the guys particularly, the desk, we went in and walked through it, and wires were hanging everywhere, and the lights were out, and dust everywhere. His desk, instead of being level, it was like that, with a big piece of concrete in the middle of it. He'd have been killed sitting there.
Sure.
And many other people would, too. It was. So we learned a lot about that.
Not
very expensive.
Right.
I've always
get one now if I can identify it. But I was also impressed that all the generals came down in a parade, you know, lined up, you know, very shortly after that.
Mm-hmm.
And some smokers, I mean, still, they rode around here, turned around, went back, never asked one question. I think it was so overpowering. This was just some time ago, and bombing things were kind of still fresh in people's minds.
So what did y'all, I mean, you moved the monitoring building or the blockhouse or whatever?
I'm not sure really what precaution they're taking now, except maybe not testing that type of thing without evacuating if they do. And the instrumentation area, though, was never put back in there. So, I mean, that operation was moved out, and just based on the fact that you can, if it's a integral function of what's going on, then you can get away with deviations. But if you went down, for example, as a non-combatant, you couldn't get in, you know. So
sure.
They moved the dissimilar functions out, even though we were tightly integrated.
I see.
They'd never been there.
Right.
And,
So then we
moved over to Marshall about a year if they were formed. I don't recall the dates on that. But
okay. 60. Marshall was formed in 60.
Yeah, I think.
So I guess you were then. You were with ABMA and.
No, I was still with the old
ARGMA. Okay.
ARGMA,
right.
And went from there went to NASA. They went into the you know Dave Newby.
Oh yes.
Well, it was Dave. He's
I talked to Dave.
Very big supporter of mine, and I appreciate Dave, and went right in with him, and then the facilities expanded, so I ran the facilities office for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
several years, and then the Apollo program really got off the ground. And then we had the facilities all across the country, you know, this
sure.
all over the place. And I did that for a number of years that we completed. And then we had the Marshall Center facilities and the external Marshall, Sacramento and Seal Beach and all those things, they were going. And I guess
Mississippi too
Mississippi
was
started and
subservient to Marshall. Right.
Right, and all that was being done. And at that same time, too, the industrial operations became bigger, and so we set up two offices, and one for facilities on the center, and one facilities in the industrial operations at O'Connor.
Right.
And that I think worked real well. I think it would work real well.
Sure.
And what we had in the Marshall organization was a lot of core of engineer people. Now, they don't move too fast. And you know,
mm-hmm.
we had a problem there. I think we conquered those problems. We did, then it didn't move fast. And we did a
right.
good job. And on the other side, we couldn't wait. So that had a colonel came in, signed from that program, and he did a good job managing that. We had most of the Corps of Engineers, you know, doing that work. But you've heard these kind of things. We ran across in Mississippi. You mentioned that was a pacing. It was a pacing item down there for a while on the Apollo programs. We saw it. The S-2 test stand was way behind schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Went down there once and found out they were driving piling in the ground. And to drive piling, you have to test it. You put a load on it, let it sit for a certain amount of time, see how much it
settles or whatever. Yeah.
And so they did this, and I said, look, you only drive one test pile at a time. I said, yeah, but it costs a lot of money. It was costing $1 million a day not to do it.
Right.
So long as we'd been down there, it might have been the same trip, I don't know. Came back, and this general who had headed up the ICBM construction in the Midwest program came to the visit. And he had all these guys with him, and he apparently saw Von Braun out of town. He did see Von Braun in the lobby 4200. And said hello to him, and Von Braun said hold back, and they introduced themselves. I'm sure of that. And he wanted to meet with Von Braun. He would have no other way. And so he contacted Von, and Von Braun asked me. He said, "What am I going to talk to the guy about?" I said, "We're not. The only thing I'm going to tell him is that his test stand in Mississippi is pacing the Apollo program, and it's the long pole in the tent, it costs $1 million a day every day we flip that thing. This guy walks in. I went in the meeting. He walks in there, and the first thing Von Brown says, you know, like, how you doing, whatever. And I said, what can I do for you? He said, I'm going to tell you. He says, you're the long pole in the tent, you know, and that kind of thing. And this guy came out. This was an expensive thing. Now, he came out and went back to Atlanta. He's from Atlanta. He's charged the whole district down to here. He was used to putting in ICBMs. So he shook the thing up. He had a daily report coming in, and he changed people on and just put massive paperwork over this thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was good necessarily, but
right.
He really got his attention. This guy, when he came out, he was just shaking his head. You know, courtesy calls are not designed for that. Go ahead, have a handshake, cup of coffee, and see you later. Let him know
where
to the bike.
Right.
But I thought that was good that he just brought that right out. I right mm-hmm. opened and
didn't fool around. And this was the head of the Corps of Engineers district?
Really in an area.
Oh, okay.
He had all the districts in the southeast.
I see.
So he was pretty high placed. He reported to the chief of ordnance, the chief of the Corps of Engineers.
The civilian?
No, it was two or three military. General. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He picked those things up there. He thought he could do anything with it.
Right.
He run through the ICB, and he did a good job up there. He did a good job in Mississippi, but he set himself up.
Right.
Yeah, he wasn't set up, but he set himself up.
Right. So you got some more Von Brown stories?
And the other thing is Stennis, talking about Mississippi. Stennis had,
right.
Jack Balch had sold Stennis and a lot of other people on men, salvation of Mississippi depends on the Mississippi Test Receipt. And the folks in Marshall are going to try to take work away from us. And he didn't want to lose anything. I don't blame him for that. He didn't want to lose a thing to Marshall. Yeah, he was trying to build an empire down there.
Mm-hmm.
And itself. I understand that. But he had an end with Stennis, and then end with, through Stennis' assistance and so forth, end with the White House, with guys like Ehrlichman. Referring back to that journal a moment ago, what Jack Balch told me in his interview, the conversation with Ehrlichman, said that thing that Von Brown went through was mild. Ehrlichman, he was a tough character, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
He put Jack Balch straight, but he still wanted him to do what he was doing for Mississippi because of Stennis.
Right.
Stennis came down, passed through this way on Mississippi in a small aircraft, and stopped by here one day and see Von Brown. So we went in the office and talked explained the program to him, pros and cons and all that, and where we were. And then he wanted to show him the area. So we got in the car and went down to the 7-5 test stand, SC-1C test stand, went on top of that thing. From that top, Bob, you may recall, you can see the cave, you can see the river, you can see everything.
Oh, yeah, I do remember.
Stennis wasn't interested in any of this. He hadn't shown a great interest in the
program.
Then we were up there on top of this test stand, and he said, Dr. Von Brown, he said, I really don't care what you do here in Huntsville. Just don't take it out of Mississippi. That's why they came through. That's all I read,
Pretty much those words.
Yeah,
right.
About those words. I mean, that was the end of the meeting.
Right.
And they planned to go back to Mississippi. And we saw lots of those things like that, and I thought, man, particularly around Mississippi, that politics, they don't miss words off the record.
Now, did Stennis, was he still up on the top of the stand when he made that?
Oh, yeah, here we are, right?
Right.
All that stuff out there, I can almost see it today, walking around. It's a strange thing, too. This really made Don Brown feel good. It made me feel better with his reaction. The night before that, I was coming home in a little Volkswagen. And I got hit in the rear end and pushed 5 cars ahead. I mean, nobody was injured. My car was total. And I had a real black eye, and my nose was pretty banged up, and I didn't feel too good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, went out to the, I knew the stands were coming. I didn't want to miss that. So I came in the room, and Von Brown had seen me. He came out of the house that night. I didn't look too good. But what he made a particular point of saying, Jim, he's in Iraq, but he only came out just to kind of show the dedication we had at Mars. And it was impressive. I thought it was impressive.
Sure.
And but it, I wouldn't have missed that one very much, because it
shows
the pressure people are under. And then a lot of us incidents
right.
like that, you know, that happened. That
were you Doc Von Braun's assistant then? Or
Yes.
Right.
We moved. That's when they split the two facilities, then I made me associate director for facilities, kind of both of those. And then Frank left for better pastures. And I'll tell you, when this will be off the record, I don't want to embarrass anything here, but we were down at Jekyll Island on a retreat. And we took the NASA plane down and went into quarters, and the quarters weren't bad, but as typical, it was a work set. I mean, it was really a working retreat. It wasn't a contract retreat, it was a working retreat. And we had long meetings, and the bars open before the night meeting, and some guys had a couple of drinks. And so the session started, and Von Braun in front of us, sitting in a kind of like a classroom, and all these chairs around it, and pretty crowded. And I was pretty close to maximum orbit, and several beyond arm's length from Frank Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Frank had a drink or two, I'm sure. And we talked about the future. We're talking about what we're going to do and how we're doing it, and what programs and missions that Martians should be involved in. And Frank used that occasion to take on Von Braun publicly by standing up and challenging our concept of launch vehicles. And
Frank
Williams.
Williams.
Yeah. He was still in tightly with Von Braun, and I wanted to reach over and grab him.
Mm-hmm.
He's down, Frank. You know, he's digging himself a hole, and it hurt Von Braun.
Because
he was a very loyal man. Von Braun was very loyal to people who worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of his attributes. He was very loyal. He looked out for you the best he could.
Right.
And he expected something back.
Sure.
Loyalty back. And not to be challenged.
Yeah. And who was, this was in a big meeting?
Big meeting. All the lab directors, all the guys.
It was all Marshall. I mean,
all internally.
And what did Frank challenge him about again?
Our approach to, I'm not sure the program now, approach to the use of launch vehicles, where we're using the right launch vehicles, and we're studying the right launch vehicles. And I thought that
for was, Apollo.
Well, no, just for the future, man.
Okay.
The Apollo's already set.
Oh, all right.
And I think, for example, in the lunar orbit or the Earth orbit concept.
Oh, okay.
He was sold on the Earth orbit. He was on lunar orbit, and they battled back and forth on this thing. The decision was made lunar orbit. Decision was made. Not another word. It just, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
We were soldiers, we marched, we do it, lunar orbit, you know. It
sure.
Suck it up, cross the fingers, and go ahead.
And Von Braun knew this.
He did this, the whole team fell behind him. So you just don't challenge that kind of, when the decision is made, you go with it.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're just going to sit around and argue all the time, you know. And we did that for that.
Sure.
But
Frank then, later, was challenging some of those.
He was challenging the future, really.
Right.
What vehicles we were designing, I don't recall the details of that more detail than recall about the shock that a lot of us felt of Frank taking him on like that publicly.
Hmm.
Now, if you didn't like it, something of that nature, go see me.
Sure.
I'll
talk with Frank later. We've scheduled a later talk.
So
I won't.
He might not remember it. If he does, he might remember it rather painfully, I think.
Sure.
I'm just telling you that.
I appreciate it.
And we didn't use those retreats and hideouts, we call them, maybe as effective we should have. I don't know if they're really effective or not. This is not a bad meeting, really, except for that one episode.
But then
another thing that we did, and you've seen this and heard about, now it's now closed, but the Hoosier Voice Tank.
Von
Braun, the idea was to create a nuclear voice facility that we could study the actual, as close as we could, emulate wavelengths in space. And so that was his idea, and
It was Von Braun's idea.
Yeah, and so how you put this thing together, you're familiar with the instructions for the money and Congress gives, and also the R&D money and all those kind of things.
Right.
You know, and the rules of how to use either one. And it just gets to one of his philosophies, too, in a minute. But the city made, let's get on it. We'll just put up a temporary building, and we'll do that with a little money we have for that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, if you've seen the building, well, it's a pretty good idea.
Yes.
And we'll build a tank as an R&D thing. We'll do it with our own people. And so the welders and people over in
Bab Lab.
Yeah, Bab Lab and the test lab.
Sure.
Began to do this thing. They had to call on David Foxworth's welder to finish up. So I thought that was all right. Because the pay scale between David Foxworth's guys were like this, you know. I mean, these guys were expert welders. But these were expert, but they weren't welding the right thing. See, well, they called on David to finish it up. And then that was built, and everything's going good. We had a 1 million gallon tank, or 2 or 3 million gallon, what it was. And one of the subcommittees on space came down, because they'd heard about it. They didn't want to see it. They didn't come down for that reason, but they wanted to see this tank. So we went down, and you know how those doors open up.
Oh, yes.
So the doors opened up, and they got out of the car, and they saw this massive tank, because it was built as equipment. That whole thing was a piece of equipment sitting there.
I see. Not as a facility.
Not as a facility. It's also movable.
Right.
Those guys, they didn't see anything. They didn't see anything there. They came back to the building, and that's when they took it up, and they put a lot of restrictions on that, so again, I built it. philosophy didn't come out this point at this time, but it reinforced what he was saying. He says, you build the facilities and take the slap on the wrist. Because the facility's still there. When you got it, Pete Work's going to come to you.
Right. What is it, ask forgiveness rather than permission?
Yeah, that's the block. I mean, once you get it, they're not going to burn it. You know, they may fire you. That's the same old risk. And that was his philosophy about this thing, and it worked. And Houston didn't support NutriBullshit. That was not in their picture. They didn't care for it. Didn't want it. Didn't want to use it. Didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have one now.
And yet they had the flight crew responsibility, right?
This thing was used, and the concept, the fundamental concept, was really great. And Don Brown, it wasn't used exactly that way. He perceived it was all engineers going in, and trying out their
for equipment development,
but really the hardware development.
Sure.
It turned out more of a training thing,
mm-hmm.
which is okay. Lots of things it turned around that way, but it was good for the other, because lots of things were found that didn't work in that, even that simulation of nutrition. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good thing. I kind of regret to see it not being used today, because it was a good thing. It was a cheap thing. I don't know what it cost, but it was very minuscule compared to the one out of Houston now. Of course, things have inflated, but it still was a low-cost operation. And it served real well, besides being something good on tour stuff. Everybody likes it.
good thing.
We had Von Braun was a scuba diver, too. He liked that. And
mm-hmm.
He dived the tank, and he talked me into going out and getting it. They knew that Dave and myself try to get our card, and Dave's ears hurt. They just he quit.
We mm-hmm.
don't understand that. And
sure,
we went on through that all that training. That it was good. We had a good training program. We had some really good guys that ran that thing. I mean, really professional guys. And we had some men from the Navy, the SEAL men, that came
mm-hmm.
and helped out with that too. But it was a well done operation.
Good.
But I appreciate his philosophy on that. When we had, you remember Hurricane Betsy?
Yes, vaguely.
Yeah, I'm kind of vague on it too, but that was some time ago. And it came through New Orleans shortly after we picked up the Michoud Assembly facility from the GSA. That plant has been there since World War II. And it had been used briefly during the Korean conflict to refurbish some tanks and things like that, but never really, and they built Liberty ships there, concrete, tried to build concrete ships there during World War II and that sort of thing. But I don't think it ever really got into any kind of good production. We got the facility, and the GSA had two men facing that building, closed up all the years.
Yeah.
And that thing kind of deteriorated. And it wasn't too good a shape in the size. That was all right. Everybody was happy about getting this big building because it was on the waterway, and we could build them there and ship them out by waterway and down the Mississippi, the intercoastal waterway up to the Cape, and all those good things.
Sure.
And it was a good investment, and it worked out well. But they went down, came from Washington down, says, look at this big piece of jewel we just picked up. And they went down shortly after Betsy. I mean, like, I don't know the time, but it was, it wished it had been longer because it was a flat roof, 43 acres on one roof, flat. And that roof hadn't been looked at, really looked at, not repaired for all these years. But it went inside the plant, beautiful plant, it was all, you know, ditch and thing like that, but beautiful, big, open
place
with water streaming down. I didn't see it, fortunately, I don't think I would have survived.
This was after the hurricane?
Yeah, after the hurricane, I don't think I would survive my job at this instant here, but it was coming out like out of a fire hose, and they're all over the place, you know, and they on ground unmercifully. You know, they just really ribbed him.
Right.
I'll get their relationships in a minute, but they really ribbed him.
And they were who again?
They were the Washington folks.
Oh, Washington NASA folks.
Washington NASA, all the Brainerd homes, and I don't think Brainerd would do it, but I mean all the sub-Brainerds were given Von Braun and people a hard time about that. And in one way, right, so it was a bad mistake. And so we came back, it came back up, and we had a regular scheduled meeting, whatever, and it was in building 4488. You may have seen that conference room with a big mahogany looking table out there, and it seated 100 people in it, whatever it was, and there was a lot of people, and they all sat around the back row there. And I was sitting across the table, it was wider than this one, because it was about this wide, which wasn't wide enough, it turns out, it was about that wide. And we were talking about, and he's talking about his trip down there. He's talking about the leaky roof of his shoe.
Right.
And he was a little upset about this.
Right.
And so Dave was sitting behind me on the back row back then. And every time Bob Brown would say something, I couldn't get Dave shut. Dave sometimes talked when he should be listening. And that time he should have been listening. But he was saying why we couldn't do these things. But here again, pots of money. You can't move money from one to the other like that. Well, that's not the time, the place, or the condition to talk about you can't do something.
Right,
just,
sure.
Just do it, you know. And so Von Braun, looking straight at me, he'd had enough. And if everybody else was kind of enjoying the conversation, they really came alert till he the table like that. He said, you get that roof fixed, and Michu, I don't need you anymore.
Right. To
me.
To you, I know.
I came out of that thing, I asked old George Constant. You remember George Constant?
Yes.
I said, George, what's going on? Me is like a bombshell to me, you know. And needless to say, we made some tracks, and we got a guy out of Chattanooga to redid the roof, and he used helicopters to bring the tar up, you know, buckets. I thought it was rather a unique thing he did, eh?
Right.
It was a good thing. Got that roof prepared in short order, you know. And I think everybody understood what was going on.
Wow, Ben, that's great.
It took a while to see the humor in that. I seen the humor in it a long time ago, but it was really, it looked back on it, a rather comical thing. And then we had another case, you remember more vividly, Hurricane Camille.
Mm-hmm.
And Mississippi Test Facility was operating at that time. Had a good-sized crew there. And Jack Balcher was running it, and the morning after the Camille hit, and I think they had winds like about 200 miles an hour and 20-foot tidal wave came in. It was really a devastating, five plus whatever you have, how they going on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack had lost a number of people. Some of his top men had lost, like one of them, his grandmother was up in a tree, she's dead up there, top of the tree. Jack's house was destroyed, and I mean, it was really devastating. And Jack reacted like most of us would. He was really upset, yeah, and he was
he was angry, he was he's afraid, he was nervous. I can't describe his emotions completely. It almost did Jack in, frankly, as the thing wound down, but he wanted help, what he wanted. So, I don't want to use Dave's name in this, but I'll use it here.
No.
I don't want this for a record. He,
all right.
He called Dave and wrapped the call and said, Dave, we got to do something here. Dave's reaction was typical German World War II in U.S. anytime. Okay, we'll get us a team down and see what they need. We'll submit a survey. One man said, Dave, so they don't need a survey. They know what they need. I want that convoy in the morning to move 8 o'clock. And boy, George, it was okay. We had both soldiers, had communication gear, radio gear,
government gear. That's right.
And they moved we were down there before the National Guard was down there with that stuff. And it stayed to the top of the city. And it was, I thought that was a lesson in action to meet a situation. It said, let's don't study a lot of these things. When you know something's bad, get it fixed. And it worked.
Interesting. That does reflect part of his management style and personality and everything.
And he's heard this thing in a way that people in that position don't normally hear.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets another meeting that reflects kind of this thing we had. Ed O'Connor and Harry Gorman, had the two sides of the house, one industrial operations and one administrative.
Right.
They had all the procurement under him, and O'Connor had all the program management under him. Well, Ed and his people wanted to have procurement authority. And it didn't sound good to me at the time. And Harry Gorman, he was violent to oppose this thing. So we had the staff luncheons every day. So we came to the staff luncheon, and this thing hadn't been worked
right
outside the staff function. It came in there, and so they started discussing, Harry and Andy did discussing the merits of the procurement ops in one place or the other for the big procurement contracts. And he had made his pitch, and Harry made his, and the tempers rose, and they really got going after each other, because one was gaining a lot, the other was losing a lot,
mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about losing power here now, and so they got kind of violent in this thing. Von Braun sitting there, he was enjoying this thing immensely.
he got through with the discussions,
it hadn't been decided, and it was decided later that the big contracts, the major contracts, would be, their procurement people would go to industrial operation. That was a good decision. But Von Braun, at the end of the meeting, he says, essentially what he said, well, this is the best meeting I've ever been in. I'm getting to hear the issues. Because see, everything was agreed to before it came up. They came up with the positions.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of like the impeachment hearings now. You got two sides of the thing now. But once it's together, they present to the, unfortunately not the president now, but the president to the boss.
Right.
He's thinking it's a united position. It wasn't that easy getting there. Yeah. But Ron Van really enjoyed it. He said, well, these guys almost killed each other. It was a professional pride, and loyalty to the organization, and all those things. The ego and everything else involved in that decision, And it wasn't easy.
How was that resolved, by the way?
I know the resolution, I think it was then mediated between Harry and Ed later, and Harry sensed from the fact that Von Braun came down that, the program's got to have these things. I mean, and it made sense to do that. We were just a little bit fearful that the program manager then would begin to dictate to the contract manager. That'd been bad.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys over there were strong enough to resist that, but yet they were flexible enough now to make the decision and make it go rather than run to another organization reporting somebody else. That was just not a good way to do it.
Sure, I
see that, and it worked real well. But it was that meeting was painful to get there, And,
right.
And really, you need that kind of conflict resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Have some conflict to make a resolution, to resolve an issue.
Sure,
will bring out the best or worst of both positions,
Mm-hmm.
I'll bring out the best of mine, bring out the worst of mine.
Right.
And so
side of Von Braun, that give me the facts, all the facts. Don't bore me, he didn't say that, but don't bore me with the minutiae details about how often both the grass. I mean, but bring me to both sides unaltered and let me hear them. And
right.
Then I can meet with whoever I need to make a decision on this thing. And
did he ultimately make the decision?
He had to decide that. And but at that point in time, it was an agreement that would happen, you know, but the ground rules were set better. And, you know, wasn't this animosity. You know, the animosity didn't last, but, you know, that meeting, it was all over.
Right.
They were great friends and supported one another. But I thought that was a good clue to Von Braun and his desire to get all sides of the story.
Mm-hmm.
How bad they were, that's, you know, we might
sure,
say.
Sure.
He was somehow thinking in Washington sometime like that. And then we had another subject. When Webb came down to visit us, we had a set kind of presentation put on for these types of things, introductory to Marshall, and we had a great graphics department. We had this brilliant guy down there in the graphics area, and they spared no concept. They couldn't put on paper and make it look good. So they didn't come up with the idea, but someone got them to lay out this chart that showed Marshall's relationships to all the other people in the space program.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess they got to have to say, where are we going to place Marshall in this relationship? Well, you can't have over here and all these arrows going this way. It doesn't look good. So Marshall, Marshall space flights, right? You got Houston over here. You got Kennedy down here. You got Washington over here. You got Sacramento over there. You got all these guns around, and we're right here.
And you're the center of the universe.
What I'm saying is that says, Truck came like it, Whip Warner said, what? Whip said, Warner? He said, what do you mean? Marshall was the center of the universe. Never heard of it, never saw that chart again. It came down, it never showed up. And he made a very valid point. Look at it, it was a very egotistical chart. And that was really not Von Braun's character.
Right.
You know, these things just slipped through without any review, and maybe review wouldn't show that, because that's where we looked at the thing, and everything that we said on that chart was okay. So it was-